Coming up on Golf Today, after an emotional win in Mexico dedicated to his friend, Eric Van Rooyen joins the program to talk about his amazing Sunday, lessons learned, and the power of friendship. And Brendan Todd checks in from Bermuda, where he won in 2019. How did that victory salvage his career, and what is next for the Georgia Bulldog? And not a lot of 15-year-olds can say they've played on the PGA Tour. Well, we know one teenager who will check that box tomorrow, but first he'll chat with us. Show and tell, gonna be real special. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday, Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. They say golfers never really retire. They just fade away. You've actually been retired. I haven't played a round of golf in a couple years, but I understand you got the itch. You might actually get inside the ropes, as it were.
And oddly, I'm a happier person for not playing. The rumor is true. I do have a tee time later this week down at Congaree, but it's in pencil. I still may not actually leave the range. I'm a happier person on the range, Damon. I like to hit balls. Don't like to have to find them.
Just the fact you have a tee time in pencil makes me very, very happy. Always speculation about when Eamon Lynch is going to play golf and also when Tiger Woods is going to play golf. As many as you may know, Tiger recently caddied for his son Charlie at the Notre Dame the Third Junior Golf National Championship, walking and carrying the bag over 4 days. This came a week after Stuart Sink said to Golf Channel that Woods told him he'd started practicing. Always speculation about when Tiger might play golf again. Well, this is what Tiger had to say to the Associated Press on Tuesday. He said, "My ankle is fine. Where they fused my ankle, I have absolutely zero issue whatsoever. That pain is completely gone. It's the other areas that have been compensated for. But all the surrounding areas is where I had all my problems, and I still do. You fix one, others have to become more hypermobile to get around it. It can lead to some issues. I'm pretty sore after caddying for 4 days. It was a flat course, thank God." Eamon, it's that time of year where everybody's wondering when we'll see Tiger Woods again. People think that December with his own, you know, Hero World Challenge, which benefits the Tiger Woods Foundation and,
still
of course,
one spot
the PNC.
Left in the field at the Hero.
In the Hero and then the PNC Championship alongside Charlie. Those have become maybe the most important tournaments to him.
Yeah, the comments that we see from Tiger are very much of the order that we're accustomed to seeing. It's not giving away too much. It's promising that the ankle is less of an issue, but he's still clearly compromised in other areas of his body. He's always going to be compromised. The question that we've been asking, I guess, for a couple of years is, to what degree is he compromised? Too compromised to win? Too compromised to compete? And we still don't have an answer to that yet, ever since he withdrew from the Masters. I expect that we're going to see him at the PNC. That's kind of his major at this point. And whether or not we see him at the Hero, you know, Michael Block might get that last spot in the Hero for all we know. But Tiger may choose to show up there as well. But in that video we just saw of him walking at least off the first tee with Charlie, he didn't look as though he was limping right there. But he did say he was tired after 4 days of caddying. 4 days of competing wouldn't leave him any less tired. But he's... I think we're getting closer to when we get an answer. Just what the answer is going to be, who knows?
He passed the eye test, as far as I'm concerned, carrying the bag, walking over 4 days. But this is kind of where we are with Tiger in his career. It's this time of year where maybe we speculate. Do we see him in December? Do we see him at Genesis? Do we see him at the Masters? But honestly, just having this carrot, as you watch the video from this past weekend, I mean, this is like manna from heaven. If you're a Tiger Woods fan, just to see him walk, he didn't walk like this when he was competing inside the ropes. There's obviously been some improvement, even if he is sore after 4 days of walking.
And I guess we'll find out what are his ambitions in golf right now, what he's enjoying most. Maybe it's doing what we're looking at right there. Maybe it's just caddying for Charlie. I was in Florida a couple of weeks ago hitting balls, and Charlie was hitting balls about 20 feet away on the range, and he was hitting them pretty well. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree on that one. But, you know, Tiger clearly has been motivated the last couple of years to play the PNC Championship with his son. That is what I assume he's working towards. At this point, that's in mid-December. Whether or not we see him before then, I think, is very much up in the air. Playing with your son when Charlie's carried him for a couple of years and that event by Tiger's own admission, playing with his son for a couple of days is very different than playing against a field of another you know, 17, 18 top players in the world for 4 days.
It's hard to know if this is the Tiger Woods portion of his career where he's like Jack, you know, in 98 as a 58-year-old at the Masters, making a great one but falling short, or if he can pull another rabbit out of the hat, pull a Jack 86, a Tiger 2019. I had a conversation with a colleague before this video came out. We were both kind of the mind, well, yeah, Tiger's probably not going to win again. 82 and 15 are the numbers. But then you see Tiger walking and looking good, and you remember, well, oh, wait, this is Tiger Woods we're talking about, and you can never really count him out. Are you ready to count him out and say that those win tallies will stay the same?
There was a time when I thought that the win tally was going to end at 79 before he even won that Masters or the Tour Championship with Zozo after that. So you can never quite write this guy. It's very easy to start etching the tombstone on that career and say, you know, these are what those numbers are. But again, it's Tiger Woods. I do know that we are going to see him some point on either January 9th or afterwards. That's when the TGL Indoor League that he is launching with Rory McIlroy takes off. Whether Tiger is playing on that first day or not, who knows? But if you have Tiger Woods, you're probably going to send him out there early with a new product. But beyond that actual indoor commitment for next winter, it's kind of hard to see where else he's going to compete. But, you know, it's going to be sparingly. He said that pretty frequently the last couple of years.
Well, good to see Tiger walking strong and obviously enjoying that time with his son. We do have some news, by the way, on this Wednesday. Earlier today, the USGA and the RNA announced the first update to the World Handicap System as part of an ongoing review of the rules of handicapping and course rating system. The latest revisions will go into effect beginning January 2024. And here are some of the key updates. Inclusion of shorter length golf courses within the course rating system, as short as 1,500 yards for 18 holes or 750 yards for 9 holes. Use of an expected score for a hole not played. 9-hole scores will be considered in the calculation of a player's handicap index immediately. Playing conditions calculation adjustments made for more frequent and enhanced guidance on conducting a handicap review. Thomas Pagel, Chief Governance Officer with the USGA, joins us now. Thomas, we appreciate the time. Why is this update happening in 2024? Were you hearing from some players? Was it the advent of shorter courses? What's the reason behind it?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me today and going over these changes. Look, you reflect back on 2020 when, with our partners at the RNA, we released the World Handicap System. So prior to that, you had 6 different handicap authorities across the globe, 6 different systems. And we really brought the world together, you know, this increasingly borderless world, so that now handicaps can translate and travel with you when you go play in other parts of the world. And when we launched that, we knew that we weren't done. We knew that there were improvements yet to be made. And for 2024, we're excited to really launch version 2.0 of WHS, right? It is a natural evolution as we look at, you know, the short courses there, those par 3 courses, 9-hole courses, obviously becoming increasingly popular. So we wanted to make sure that as golfers embrace and enjoy these different formats, these different styles of golf courses, that they're able to include those within their handicap. And, you know, you often think of resorts that are opening these shorter courses like the Cradle at Pinehurst, but you also think about golf and inclusion and engaging different communities. And as golf becomes closer to urban city centers, maybe played on smaller footprints, those scores and those players will be playing under the rules of golf, and they'll be able to post scores to their handicap, or even golf courses that put in shorter tees for families to enjoy. So we're really excited about continuing the theme of inclusivity, of engagement, of having a modern system that really reflects how people are playing the game today and how they want to play the game.
How will the typical recreational golfer, someone who's been around the game for a while, who already has a handicap, where are they going to see the impact of this, Thomas, versus somebody who's just getting into the game now, who perhaps doesn't actually yet have a handicap and wants to work towards that? It's got to be two very different interfaces with this new handicap system, right?
Yeah, I mean, those that have an existing handicap, we went through change in 2020, albeit here in the U.S. it was relatively small. I think the number one thing golfers are going to start to see in 2024 is how we treat 9-hole scores, right? Currently, you take a 9-hole score, you post it, and it's going to sit in your handicap record until you play another 9 holes. We want the system to be more responsive. We want the system to really account for the increased popularity of 9-hole play. So starting in 2024, when you post a 9-hole round, we're actually going to go ahead and provide an expected score for the second nine based on the golf course you're playing, based on your handicap index. And that's now going to count right away towards your handicap index. So again, if you think about the changes for 2020 and the next day updates or next day revisions, now those nine hole scores are going to be included. So I would say that'll be the number one change that golfers that are used to having a handicap index are going to notice.
Just on those nine hole scores, Tom, the number of golfers who have a handicap already, who filed nine hole scores last year, it was 27% of scores filed by women. It was half of that for men. But for golfers with a newly established handicap, say within the last 12 months, those numbers are 45% for women, 21% for men. What does that tell you about the audience that is coming into this game and starting to establish a handicap? It doesn't suggest that it's the old audience that's out there grinding on 18 hole rounds over the course of 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah, Eamon, first of all, it tells me two things. One, if you look here in the U.S., we have about 3.2 million golfers currently with a handicap index. That's up tremendously since 2020. So we are seeing an increased engagement with the game, increased popularity. And with that, people are getting handicaps. And we're trying to make it easier than ever for a golfer to get a handicap. They can now sign up at usga.org/WHS, join their local Allied Golf Association, and be off and running. So the popularity is certainly there. And then from the nine-hole perspective, again, I think it just shows how people are engaging with the game. You know, people, whether you have an existing handicap or you're new to the game, you know, finding that time after work or before work to go play nine-hole rounds, perhaps it's not as taboo as it once was. And with that, we're also seeing an increase in leagues that are specific to nine-hole play. So people are just really excited to be outside playing the game. And if that means playing nine holes instead of 18, I think people are embracing that. And frankly, it's time for the WHS to embrace that and reflect it as well.
Thomas, I've always considered a handicap index like a golfer's driver's license. Why is a handicap index important to begin with in your mind?
Yeah, really, there's two reasons. One, the reason that the handicap system was put in place over 100 years ago, right? It's to provide an opportunity for fair and equitable play. So, Damon, when you and I step up to the first tee, we can look at our handicap index, compare ourselves against each other, and have a game where we're giving strokes or not giving strokes. So that's number one. But then, you know, something we're hearing more and more from golfers, especially as technology increases and these apps, the Gin app and others, have the ability to track stats. It's really a way to track your performance as a golfer. You know, golf is very aspirational, inspirational. We all want to improve. And having a handicap shows you your performance level, shows where you are relative to other golfers, and really gives you that desire to want to achieve more, want to get better.
Thomas, any concern about potential abuses? Some golfer going out to a short, easy course and spinning around a few times to kind of lower that handicap. Any concerns about that?
Look, it is like with the rules of golf, you know, we treat it as a game of integrity. The rules of handicapping have always had checks and balances. That's why we use, you know, your lowest eight out of your 20. There are triggers in the system that actually allow that allow for committees. And we're trying to enhance those triggers, allow for committees to have the data or information to see if somebody's dropping too fast or increasing too fast, to have guardrails to protect those against. But, you know, that's always existed. We don't see these changes increasing that. And again, we actually see a very low instance rate, especially here in the U.S., of people manipulating handicaps. Again, most people want that fair and equitable game, and they want to see how they perform against other golfers.
The mere fact that he would ask that question, Thomas, is a red flag to all of his playing compartments out there.
Let's watch out for Damon.
What's next in this system, Thomas? I mean, there's always been this perception, rightly or wrongly, that the handicap system is some kind of antiquated relic that most golfers don't actually understand the wiring of. How many more steps can you take to simplify this process?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it's always going to be a complex process, especially when you're looking at golf courses and measuring the difficulty of certain tees on a golf course. It's always going to be complex. But what we want to do is we want to rely on the data. We have a robust data set, more than 75 million scores posted in the U.S. alone last year, where we can mine that data and really confirm or verify that course ratings are accurate, that golfers' abilities are accurate. And so for us, you know, as we think from version 2.0 to 3.0, it's how can we rely on that data more to make sure that it's even more accurate tomorrow than it is today. So this is a work in progress. It's something we're very excited to share with the golf community. Again, one of the things the USGA has been involved with for over 100 years, But when we partnered with the RNA in 2020 to really have this single worldwide system that's now adopted in 125 countries, it's just very exciting for us. And again, golfers are out there embracing it, using technology, playing the game, using their handicap index as that performance evaluation. So we just look forward to again, further refinements in the future so we can make it better for all golfers.
I use it. Speaking of accuracy, I'm a 16, but I'm a dangerous 16, as many out there know.
I bet you are.
Thomas, we appreciate the update. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, up next, we're going to visit with a man who authored one of the more improbable comebacks we've ever seen from a struggling PGA Tour player. And he did it at this week's venue in Bermuda. Brendan Todd, he's coming up next. We're back on Golf Today. PGA Tour is in Bermuda. This week, you can catch live first-round coverage of the Butterfield Bermuda Championship from Port Royal Golf Club tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Golf Channel. Let's jog back to 2019, the inaugural edition of this event. Brendan Todd closed with a final round of 10-under par 62 to win by 4 shots. It was his second PGA Tour victory, and it came just 2 months after he regained his PGA Tour card in the Korn Ferry Tour Finals.
How about a closer look at Brendan's CV? 3 wins, including 2019 in Bermuda, as you mentioned. 47th in the FedEx Cup standing, so into the designated events next year. Georgia Bulldog was a 4-time All-American, won the SEC Championship back in 2004. And time now for a past champ chat with the 2019 champ, Brendan Todd. Great to see you. I want to go back to 2019, 100 starts between victories. That Sunday, you said you had one of the best warm-ups that you'd had in some time. What constitutes a great warm-up?
Man, my golf swing was feeling really good that day. I can remember Justin Leonard standing behind me and you know, everything was just really in sync. I was hitting the ball really solid, which you've got to do here in the wind. So, yeah, great warm-up there. The putting was feeling really good that week, and I went out there and got hot.
You certainly did get hot, Brendan. You shot 62 on that Sunday. What were the nerves like closing that one out? I know you'd been a winner before, but you'd had some pretty rough sledding between that victory and the victory in 2019 in Bermuda. So how did it feel putting together that 62 when you knew it was at stake?
Yeah, you know, I had a, I think I was in the last group on Saturday with Scottie Scheffler and Harry Higgs. And so I feel like I got some of the nerves out that day. And then Sunday was just, you know, just another round in the final group. And like I said, with my warm-up being so good, I was able to go out there and really feel comfortable and hit my targets and make some putts early to settle the nerves. And I was able to build up a pretty big lead, being 9-under through 11 holes that day, to where, you know, the last 5 holes, I was really just playing some smart golf and executing my shots and was pretty comfortable coming in.
Brendan, you mentioned Harry Higgs. He said that every shot you hit was perfect on Sunday. Every putt was perfect. Were you pulling the right clubs, getting the right numbers? What happens when you play a round of golf like that?
I think it had to be a mixture of pulling the right clubs and getting the right numbers. You know, I can remember hitting a pin high on one. I hit it to 3 feet on 3 feet on 4 3 feet on 10, you know, 4 feet on 11. So, you know, you don't do that just by hitting perfect shots all the time. Sometimes it's just your day, and you're always out there just having the right number. My caddy, Don Gabber at the time, and I were just really in sync, and it was a special day that, you know, I'll never forget, and it was fun to beat down Harry.
At one stage in the run-up to that victory, Brendan, you'd gone, I think it was 37 missed cuts out of 40 events. Was there a low point during that? Because when you look back at the numbers, it's not as though you went out every week and were shooting a pair of 80s. You were missing cuts narrowly. Which, is it more frustrating when it's one big miss on a given day rather than just a series of high scores?
I'm not sure what's more frustrating, but I can say there were a couple low points. You know, I missed a lot of cuts at the end of 2016 to lose my card. And then in 2017 and 18, I was playing off of the past champions category. And at the end of 2018 season, you know, I remember being at the Wyndham Championship qualifier and playing poorly on the front nine and pulling out and just being like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get my game back. You know, it's been, at that point, it had been about 2.5 years of bad golf. And so, you know, I was took some time off and was considering some other options. But after a little bit of time at home, I was able to find Brad Hughes and Ward Jarvis and work hard on my game, get ready for Q School. And then I Mondayed into the RSM in 2018 and built some momentum there, making the cut. So, you know, I don't know. It was a really tough stretch, and you know, I'm glad I fought through it and, you know, kept believing and kept working at it.
Brandon, you told me at one of the low points you considered opening a pizza franchise. You were talking to people in the business world. Have you gotten rid of all those business cards and contacts? What have you done with all that information that you were looking into?
Yeah, they went straight in the trash in 2019, buddy. I didn't really want to do that. I've always been a golfer at heart, but I've dreamed of playing on the PGA Tour my whole life, dreamed of winning out here and contending in majors. So, you know, I'm so thankful to have gone through the struggle and come out the other side. And, you know, now feel like I'm playing the best golf of my life, and I've still got the future ahead of me.
It certainly has been a tremendous turnaround. You're now inside the top 50 in the FedEx Cup standings. You're in all of those signature events next year, Brendan. Are you a fan of this new structure of the PGA Tour in how the fall has sort of been separated, how these signature events have been built up?
Not really. I like how the system was with the fall counting toward the FedEx Cup. And I do appreciate the shorter season, January through August. But, you know, for a majority of the guys, 51 through 200, they're still playing in the fall for their cards. So, you know, why not just put that towards the next season like we had been? Having the fall count did not hurt any of the top players from contending in the FedEx Cup. The best players rise to the top every year and are contending for the FedEx Cup. So, you know, I think that this was more just a reaction to where things are in the golf world. And, you know, I'm good with it. I'm happy that I grinded. I played more events this year to work my way into the top 50. And, you know, I'm proud of the way I played and fought and had some great weeks this year. And I'm really excited about, you know, being in the signature events next year and playing for all the money and all the points. But, you know, do I think it's the perfect system? I'm not sure it is. But, you know, there's a lot of different things happening in professional golf right now. And I think it's important that the PGA Tour, you know, does make adjustments and stay strong. And, you know, I'm just happy to have a job out here.
Brendan, like you, Lucas Glover is into the signature events as well. But he says he's afraid that the tour is trending toward a two-tour system. Do you understand his observation? Even though he's into those events like you, he's concerned about those players that are fighting to make the money that the top guys are making.
Well, I think you're going to have a much bigger disparity in the money, that's for sure. You know, personally, when I was a rookie on tour in 2009 and then got my card back in 2012, with the four World Golf Championship events, the three invitationals, the four majors, and the playoffs, it felt like a two-tour system back then as well. The top guys were playing 16 events that the rest of the tour wasn't playing, and they were earning a ton of points and a ton of money. So this is not new. This is really just a recalibration going backwards in time. And, you know, I think that's always going to be a bit of the nature of the tour because, you know, we're trying to have a tour that runs all week, every week, all year long, and, you know, satisfies playing opportunities for 150 plus guys. So, you know, I think the way they've done it has always worked. And, you know, this is just another iteration of what the tour has been doing for 25 years. And it's Lucas and I's job to go out there and play our best and contend as much as we can and make as many points as we can.
And one of the changes the tour made in years past, Brendan, was starting the wraparound season. And both of your victories, back-to-back weeks in 2019, right there in Bermuda and also at Mayakoba, were in that fall series. Do you feel as though the fall now is diminished in any way by how it's currently structured? Or has it actually been given more identity, that there's a little more at stake for most of the guys who are playing?
Well, I think it's just a totally different mentality. You know, when it's on the front end of the season, guys are going out trying to work on their games and earn some points, try to get hot, get some momentum for the season. I always treated the fall pretty seriously because I looked at it as an opportunity to earn a bunch of points and get ahead. But now it's, you know, it's more cutthroat, a little more do or die. And, you know, that's more of a negative situation to put players in. But they're going to have it at some point in the season or the other, whether it's in the summer or the fall. And I think for the tournaments, except for maybe this one and the RSM that are at the end of the fall, they get to kind of be the anchor where guys are really deciding whether or not they keep their card or whether they finish top 60. you know, they probably get rewarded, but the other ones probably get diminished because, you know, they don't have FedEx points. They don't have as big of a reason for some of the top guys to come play. And, you know, the fall was the best thing going for Korn Ferry graduates. It was the best thing going for young players coming out on tour because they got to carry momentum from the summer or from when they earned their card into the fall and start earning points right away. Versus now, the Korn Ferry season's been over for a month, and they've got to wait until the January to start their season. And when they do start, they're going to play three courses in Palm Springs, two courses at Torrey Pines. They're not going to get in Pebble Beach, so it's going to be a grind for those guys. It's going to be a rude awakening.
I'm sure it's nice to be back at Port Royal, where you had such a big win back in 2019. Thanks for the time. Best luck this week.
You got it, guys. Thanks.
And still ahead on Golf Today, what were you doing when you were 15 years old? Well, if you're Oliver Betchar, be teaming up at a PGA Tour event this week. Next, we meet the Teen Phenom, who'll be playing with the pros tomorrow in Bermuda. Stay tuned.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Back on Golf Today, some strong players in Bermuda this week. Major champs like Adam Scott and Lucas Glover. How about the run Camilo Vijaygas had last week, and the amateur Nick Dunlap in the field? And speaking of youngsters, how about this story? PGA Tour putting this out on social media. 15-year-old Bermudian Oliver Betchar will tee it up at the Bermuda Championship, the youngest player to compete on tour in nearly a decade. He's been a standard bearer. In fact, in 2019 was a standard bearer when Brendan Todd, who we just spoke to, won the championship. And Monday Q Info saying he's been a volunteer, caddy, been on the tournament staff, and now he will play. And great to have Oliver with us from Bermuda. Now, last year you were a shot away when you were 14. You said it was your goal for the entire year to get into this field. So how did you set up a plan to get into this field at the age of 15?
I mean, it's a lot of hard work and dedication. You got to really commit to what you're out here to do and set your goals, set your sights high, and you know, achieve those goals.
You certainly achieved that, Oliver. You're now standing on the range at a PGA Tour event. You're going to tee off there tomorrow. How many times have you hit that first tee shot in your head already? What are the nerves like as you get ready for tomorrow?
I mean, the nerves are definitely there, but I don't think they're a bad thing. You know, I've visualized the first tee shot so many times over and over in my head before I go sleep, and just every second of every day, pretty much. It's a very, very, very big anticipation there for that first tee shot.
It was windy in the qualifier. You shot 68 in the final round. What are you most proud of in getting the job done?
I'm definitely proud of, I mean, my whole team, my coach, my parents, all of the support that I've had so far. I mean, I wouldn't be here without them, and that's kind of the key to my success, you know. It's all the support that I've been getting so far.
You're playing alongside Michael Sims, who's also from Bermuda. He's almost 30 years older than you, Oliver. How well do you know him, or is that a kind of a comfortable pairing for you in what would otherwise be an uncomfortable situation?
I mean, he's another local player, so I mean, I've played with him many times before, and we're good friends, and I'm really excited to be able to play with him on Thursday and Friday.
Oliver, I read where you really fell in love with golf, with something that happened when you were 7 years of age on the par 3 third hole at Port Royal. What happened?
Well, I was just a regular round of golf practicing with my brother. I was still playing off the red tees back then. I hit my driver to a middle pin location. I remember it kind of rolling back down the bank into the hole, and me and my brother were in disbelief standing there, and very, very excited, both of us. And we ran over to my mom and my coach, and we told them what happened. And, you know, that was kind of the turning point for me, the point that I knew that golf is what I want to do with my life.
Let's hope the karma continues this week. You've achieved the goal of getting into the field that you set for yourself this week, Oliver. What is a good week for you from this point on?
I'd say goal to shoot. I mean, if I had to put a number out there for these or for till up to the cut, you know, I'd say a good score would be two rounds of 68 or 67 would be really good for me. And that's what my goal is for scores for the week. But just kind of focusing on that first shot on Thursday, teeing it up there, and just focusing on the next shot and not too far into the future.
You have such a connection to this tournament. You volunteered, been a standard bearer. You caddied for Kamiko Smith as well. What did you learn as a caddy inside the ropes that could help you as a player this week?
I think that the biggest thing that I learned is just stay focused. Don't worry about anybody else. You know, you just play your own game. Don't get distracted by anything. And anything you have to do to say hi to people or do anything like that, just do it after the round, after you're done. Just when you're having those 4 hours of playing, just focus totally and concentrate on your game.
If not for playing in this tournament on the PGA Tour this week, what would you be doing? Algebra 2? History? What would you be doing this week normally on a Wednesday, Thursday?
I mean, Jordan, who is one of the tournament staff as well, told me that, you know, if I end up not qualifying, he'd be happy to take me under his wing again and be helping out the tournament staff here this week, which was very exciting last year as well, just knowing what's going on behind the scenes and all of the work that goes into one of these events.
Oliver, best of luck this week. Those PGA Tour pros are not that scary. Have fun, and we hope to speak to you soon.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
The coolest high schooler in golf this week. Well, one of the most emotional moments we've seen in the game this year came on Sunday when Eric Van Rooyen won the Worldwide Technology Championship at Diamante Resort in Mexico. Eric has since spent some time with the man who inspired him to that victory, and he joins us next. We'll be right back.
We are back on golf today. It's back to Sunday. Thrilling finish in the Worldwide Technology Championship. Eric Van Rooyen finished birdie, then an eagle at the 72nd hole to take the title in Los Cabos, Mexico. Finished at 27 under par for second PGA Tour victory. It was a final round 63 for Van Rooyen, finishing two shots clear of Matt Kuchar and Camilo Villegas. Following the win, an emotional Van Rooyen fought back tears as he dedicated his victory to former college teammate John Trasimer, who is battling cancer.
Oh, what a dream finish for you guys. I mean, to make big putt after big putt down the stretch to eagle the last. How are you able to be so calm when the stakes were the highest?
Sorry. I was calm because there's bigger stuff in life than golf. If you look at my ball, we've got, you know, there's a little music note. It's a little faded now, but there's a little music notes on there and initials JT, and it's for John Trasimer, our best friend, who's got melanoma and he's not gonna make it. And every shot out there today was for him. And when you're playing for something bigger than winning some silly trophy, you know, it puts things in perspective. And at the end of the day, whether I won here or whether I lost here, it really did not matter. So, yeah, you know, when something motivates you like that, whether you make a pot or miss a putt, who cares?
You two guys were college teammates. You mentioned John was one of your teammates at Minnesota. How did you channel that emotion and not let it drag you down and have this beautiful result?
It dragged me down. You know, after Friday's round, I shot, I think, what did we shoot Friday? 8 under?
4-8.
8 under on Friday. And I get to my hotel room and I just break down in tears, you know? So it wasn't that calm all the time, but when I step onto the golf course, I've got a freaking job to do. And that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Do your job, and now we can celebrate and cry and do whatever you want. But until that last putt drops, you know, it's focus and it's do it for Trazzy.
And Eric Van Rooyen joins us now. Eric, after your victory, you said you were going to visit with your best friend. How was your visit with John?
Yeah, it was good. It was needed. It was a bunch of us that was there, me, Alex, a few old college teammates. We're all very close. We're all close to John. So we were all down at the Mayo Clinic yesterday visiting him and saying our last goodbyes.
Tell us about John, Eric. I know, obviously, you're very close with him, but what should people know about John Trasimar?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I came to the U.S. in 2009 for the first time to come play college golf at the University of Minnesota. John is from Minnesota, a town called Blue Earth area, and he drove two and a half hours to come to the airport just to see me for 5 minutes and say hi. That's the type of guy that he is. You know, he's got an amazing heart. He loved golf. He still played professionally. And in April, he was cancer-free, and he was going to try and go back to Q school this year. And then obviously the cancer came back, and things took a turn for the worse. But John was an incredible competitor. You know, he called me and I asked him how he's doing, and he'd always say, "I'm doing great. Things are going well." And meanwhile, he's in pain. And he's struggling, and that's the type of guy he is. His glass is always half full, and just a heart this big, just a massive heart. So just a spectacular guy.
Eric, you said you and your teammates visited him to say your goodbyes. Was he aware of what you accomplished this past week?
Yeah, he was aware. He was sort of dozing in and out throughout conversation yesterday, but on Sunday, Donald Constable, an old teammate of ours, he was there on Sunday, and they were watching golf, and they were saying he'd perk up every time Matt hit in the last hour of play. Apparently, he was glued to the screen, so I'm glad we could bring a smile to his face. And, you know, yesterday we talked a lot about college times, rounds of golf that we played together, and he'd smile, and he talked about course design to some of our friends, and he'd just get the biggest smile on his face. So, I mean, he's absolutely mad about golf. So yeah, yesterday was special.
You said after you won on Sunday, Eric, that you didn't really feel stressed because there are obviously such more important things in life. Yeah. But and while I understand that golf doesn't seem stressful in that kind of situation against that kind of backdrop, you had to feel a little bit of stress going into that week. You were the guy on the bubble in terms of what you said was your job to do, to keep your status on the PGA Tour. How much stress did you feel outside of all of the personal anguish around John?
Yeah, you're spot on, Eamon. It's still my job, and it's still my dream to play the PGA Tour. So there was pressure. I think I almost felt more of that previously during the bigger part of the season, because I was coming back from injury last year, and up until recently my golf struggled, and I was feeling the pressure earlier, and started working with Sean Foley about 3 months ago, and a lot of conversation we have is about perspective, about the fact that you know, one day when my time comes and I kick the bucket, what is it that I'm going to remember? And it's going to be the people that you're with, the loved ones that will be in that room. That's what you're going to want to talk about. So ever started working with Foley, that's the type of conversations we've had, perspective, the fact that I'm a massive competitor and I want to win, but it's secondary to getting better every day and following this process, as cliche as that sounds. So I felt that pressure early in the season, and I think slowly but surely it almost started just sitting on the back burner. And whether I made, you know, kept my card and finished top 125 or not, I was still going to play professional golf somehow, somewhere, whether it be Korn Ferry or DP World Tour, and try and claw my way back into the top echelons of the game. So I knew I would always have golf. The pressure was there on Sunday, but, you know, it was secondary to other things.
Eric, you said whether you won or lost, it wouldn't have mattered, but did you sense that something mystical, something magical, was there something larger at work happening last week?
Yeah, without a doubt in my mind. On hole 15, you saw Matt Kuchar make an 8 on Saturday. an absolute treacherous hole if you miss it on the left. And on Sunday, I pulled my second shot left of a flag that is left. And so midway through the flight, I gave up on it. And I thought it was going to go down into the penalty area and probably double bogey written all over it. And by grace of our Heavenly Father, it stayed up somehow, you know. And it's funny in that moment because I got up to it, and you know how it's sort of etiquette for the players furthest away to play. And even though I was just on the fringe, I asked Matt, I was like, Matt, do you mind if I come up? And he kind of gave me a smile and said, yeah, come up. Because I was so worried about that ball rolling down and into the hazard, because it was just balancing on one little blade of grass. That moment, if I look back now, it's almost as if the whole day was just meant to be.
You played that last 9 holes, 8 under par, Eric. It was quite spectacular to watch coming down the stretch. What does it feel like to be in a zone like that, that most of us, we couldn't find our way there with a bag full of traveler's checks? We'd never get there. What does that feel like for the rest, for a guy like you?
It's hard to explain because, you know, the whole day I wasn't really in it. I mean, Camilo got off to a hot start. Matt made a few birdies early. And I mean, I started with bogey on one, right? Kind of a soft bogey, to be honest. And so immediately I was behind the 8 ball. But we had a conversation. Alex and I had a conversation on the 8th fairway where I looked at him and I said, you know, I really want to win this thing. And he smiled at me. He's like, trust me, me too. And then he said, but the one thing we can't do is push, because the minute you push and you try and go at flags that aren't, you know, there to be aimed at, you're going to start making bogeys and you know, then there's just no way. So, and ironically, I missed that green and then got it up and down the one hole that we talked about not pushing. So I just kind of hung around. And when that set up on 15, and then when I made the putt on 16 of like, okay, hang on, like, you know, something's going to happen here. And then I drained the one on 17, which was mind blowing. And walking to the tee on 18, I'm just trying to breathe. I'm like, one step at a time, just breathe. Don't get ahead of yourself. I was 2 over for 18. For hole 18 that week, which again is a super easy par 5, and I was like, just get this thing in. So the zone is a strange place. The minute you try and get there, you're probably going to slip through your fingers. I didn't push at all, and it just came together.
Eric, there's a GoFundMe page for John and Allie. It's raised $146,000, seeking $150,000. What kinds of acts of kindness have you seen during this time for the family?
Yeah, massive. I mean, so many people have reached out. Obviously, through the world of social media, there's a lot of people I don't even know. People have sent messages of, you know, I know what you're going through. My mom's passed recently of cancer, or something to the like of that. So a lot of people... you know, the one thing in this world that we're guaranteed is that we'll all experience some form of suffering at some point in our lives, right? We're going to lose a loved one. We're going to lose something that's dear to us. So that's going to happen. But if we can find love in all of that, and if we've got people around us, you know, it makes the pain just a little bit less. So for all the messages that have come out, we're all so thankful. I know Ali and John, they've seen a lot of them. So, yeah, we're incredibly grateful.
Eric, I know your heart is heavy. Your golf and your humanity were something to behold this past week. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, guys, and thank you for having me.
As we go to break, a picture of Eric and John. Incredible friendship and a win for Trazzy.
Angel Yin has had expectations heaped on her since she joined the professional ranks, and she's beginning to deliver on them. She just won the Buick LPGA Shanghai, and she's joining us to talk about that and what's coming next. And this guy delivered one of his best rounds of the year when he most needed it at the weekend. Charlie Weiss' late charge up the leaderboard on the PGA Tour Champions earned him a job for 2024. The original Wii Golf coming up as Golf Today continues. Welcome back into Golf Today alongside Damon Hack. I'm Eamon Lynch. That was a pretty emotional interview there with Eric Van Rooy, and it's hard to imagine that something else that's going to happen or has happened in golf this year could top that in terms of the emotional weight of what's going on, particularly when he talked about the how close John appears to be to the end in terms of slipping in and out of conversation with his friends who've gathered.
Yeah, it made me think about different events that have happened throughout the history of sports, dedications as they were. Dan Jansen for his sister, wonderful Olympian. I think about Tiger in 06 in tears, mm-hmm. winning the Open. Phil, when his wife Amy was battling cancer, winning the Masters. And in 2010, Ben Crenshaw, you know, in the throes of grief for burying Harvey Pinnock, his mentor, winning the Masters out of nowhere in 1995. You think about these dedications, these moments, these athletes are able to kind of compartmentalize somehow, as Eric said in his interview with George Savarikas, could be crying in his hotel room after every round of golf, but then when he's inside the ropes, that was a sanctuary, a place where he could handle his business. A beautiful interview with Eric. I'm very glad he joined us today.
And what really struck me in that moment of victory on Sunday, this is the guy who came into that week right on the bubble at 125. Mm. And there wasn't a celebration. There wasn't the fist pumping, the cheering, the hands held aloft, any of that. He just simply turned with that look on his face to his caddy, Alex, also John's college roommate. They knew what it meant, and what it meant had nothing to do whatsoever with FedEx Cup standings or job security. Nothing.
So many reasons to love this game, and Eric Van Rooy gave us another big reason to love this game even more. And lots of golf to watch this week. As you are well aware, LPGA Tour in Bel Air, Florida, the Pelican Golf Club for the Annika. It's the last event before the season-ending CME Group Tour Championship. You can catch live first-round coverage tomorrow, 10 a.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel.
Let's take a look at who's in the race to the CME Globe, and here are the current standings with only a couple of weeks left on tour. Céline Boutier has had a heck of a year, and she's got a big lead in that over Lilia Vu. But there's a lot of heavy firepower in that top 10 chasing her. And we're going to time now for a Golf Today roundtable. We're going to welcome in Beth Ann Nichols from Golf Week magazine and our own Paige McKenzie. And Beth Ann, I want to start with you. Of all of the storylines that we've seen this year, as we come to the end of the season, there's a lot of positive storylines. There's always one surprise where you thought some player was really going to be on the list of player of the year, major winner, who suddenly seemed to fall flat. And I look at the list and I see Lydia Ko. And is she on your radar at all as what's going on with Lydia this season?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's been a shocking year for Lydia. And to hear her talk just several months ago about the amount of self-inflicted pressure that she felt this year, you know, wanting to follow up such a memorable 2022 season where she swept the postseason's awards. Of course, she got married. It was the comeback year for Lydia Ko. And then to have a great start to the year and then just basically lay an egg for a very long time. She went like 8 months without a top 10 and was struggling with her short game and just wasn't sharp at all. And we've seen her turn it around a little bit here in Asia, where she shockingly again played on sponsor exemptions. But she's currently 101 on the CME points list, which means that, technically speaking, the top 100 keep their full card. But, because Lydia won in 2022, she can play off of Category 4 as a past winners category for the past 2 years. And we'll get plenty of starts next year. But, you know, really raises the questions of how much longer are we going to see Lydia compete? You know, I know that competing in Paris in the Olympics remains a big goal of hers. And, I think you always want to end on a high note, right? So we can only hope that we'll see that for Lydia, if indeed we are nearing the end of her career.
This is by far the, I think, most surprising player between 2022 and 23 season. And you explained it, Beth Ann. A lot of it had to do actually with ball striking this year. Never been a strong driver off the tee statistically, but to see what happened with her iron play this season, she only hit 65% of the greens in regulation so far this season. That is the first time in her career that she's ever been below 67%. Only one other time has she been ranked outside the top 40 on the LPGA Tour, and this season ranks 114th in greens in regulation. So when you want to dial into what has been different, that's been a big part of why we've seen the decline in the level of play from Lydia Ko. And more importantly, it wasn't just last year. It felt like since COVID, there was such a base and trajectory that she was creating. And I think that's why this was the big surprise. It wasn't that there was this great one-year comeback last season. It took 2 years for her to kind of climb her way back into this level of play that we got a chance to see last season. And I think that's where the fall off this season is that much more surprising.
Yeah, twice as many missed cuts as top 10s, 4-2. Now, Beth Ann, Annika Sorenstam didn't miss many cuts, height of her power. She now has her name attached to this event at the Pelican. What's the significance of that?
You know, I think it's really important for the LPGA. You know, when I think about the last couple of years and how many giants in the game that we've lost, that you know, all the founders are gone now. Of course, Kathy Whitworth recently, Betsy Rawls. You know, and Annika's in her early 50s, and I love that she is in this position. She obviously has tournaments all over the world at all levels, from junior golf to college golf. But for her to have her own event on the LPGA, it feels really big here. The purse is big. Players like the golf course. It's a great field. You know, I think it's important not only for players to get to see Annika, you know, for throughout the week, because she's going to be very hands-on in everything. But I just think in general for the tour to celebrate the history, and you hope that this is something that carries on for decades to come, because we've seen a lot of LPGA legends have events over the years that have petered out. And you would hope that that for Annika, that she would have a lasting one.
And setting an incredible example for the younger players. I think when you look at the PGA Tour over the course of their history, they've had those role models that have stayed engaged through tournaments, that have taught and shown how to be the best professional golfer. And it's more than just how you hit golf balls. It's how you treat people, and it's how you give back to the game and give that kind of growth for the next generation. And on the women's side, We've had the Founders Cup, and obviously the Founders were such an incredible part of that event over the last 15 years. But to have somebody like Annika continue to be involved, I think it sets an incredible tone for those players, that it's not just about the time inside the ropes. It's not just about the time when you're on the LPGA Tour. You can have an impact in this game for an entire lifetime. And I think that's a lasting legacy that Annika will always have.
Speaking of impacts, Paige, I wanted to ask you about take you back a couple of weeks when Lexi played the Shriners in Las Vegas. A remarkable performance that just seemed to captivate the golf world for days. And she'd been coming out of such a kind of a dark place with her game earlier this year. She seems to have turned the results around. Do you think that's going to propel Lexi into a more positive place with her own game, a more positive mind space with the game?
I would expect so. And I think that particular tournament, more than anything, I learned a lot about Lexi Thompson. I think one of the things that is incredibly difficult to watch is when a player puts themselves in a position and then doesn't fulfill. And Lexi's been in that before, whether it's a short miss putt at the end, whether it's a major championship that she didn't capture. And this was an opportunity for her to be in an incredibly uncomfortable situation. All those situations before, she played her way into uncomfortable. This was a choice. And to see the way that she performed, it was incredibly admirable. I thought she held herself with great poise. She played good golf, especially on that that second round. I was glued to the TV, as was so many other people, or the first round, excuse me, glued to the TV to see how she was going to do. And to see what that may do for her, to be able to put herself in that position. I don't know very many players under the scrutiny that she's had in her career that would go into a situation like that where you got potentially more scrutiny. So I certainly hope that the trend of her golf will continue, but also that her confidence level will continue with the level of play that she did in that spotlight.
Paige, I completely agree. And when I look at all the praise that she received inside the ropes from her fellow playing competitors as well, who are impressed with what they saw, you know, I think that Lexi has to come into this week, even though there's a little bit of scar tissue here at Pelican. You know, she's come so close. She's finished runner up the past 2 years, but it's such a familiar place where, you know, she plays well. And I look at the fact that she was able to hit driver so much in the desert, that she was T13 through two rounds in driving accuracy. She averaged just over 300 yards off the tee in Vegas. And I think that confidence with the driver can really carry over here at Pelican, where she has an advantage with her length.
Beth, how about another American star, Nellie Korda, who's won the last couple of Pelicans? I was watching a video of her putting. Gone is left hand low. Now she's conventional. She's got a mallet putter now. What else is going on with that part of her game?
Well, it's just interesting to hear her listen to the fact that she felt like she'd go onto a practice putting green and feel like she was kind of flying blind. She didn't really have a plan to know what her tendencies are. And then, you know, a drill that she could do to work on that tendency. And now that she's hired a putting coach and Eric Dietrich, she feels like she's more organized in how she goes about with her putting. And she says, it's not that I was putting bad. You know, she's about 46, I think, in strokes gained putting on tour. So, but she said she felt like this was an area where she could really dial in and improve. And so, you know, you love that to see that mentality from Nellie. And anytime a player, you know, feels like they're making progress towards something and they have really something tangible to work toward, which she definitely is feeling that way. You know, you feel like good results, good things are coming.
Well, it is interesting. After I read your article on this, I went and looked at the statistics to see where the fall off was in the putting. It was actually really difficult to find any fall off whatsoever. And I know she's complained about certain aspects of her putting over the course of the season. I specifically remember, I think it was the Women's British, where she was down on this, the way that she'd been putting. But so much of it statistically had not changed. But I think that gives you some insight into the incremental improvement that every athlete is trying to achieve, even when you don't notice a fall off. But then also, I think you have a great point there, Beth Ann. When an athlete has a roadmap, when they have clear and definitive things to work on, that gives you a lot of confidence knowing that you can make progress. This is a sport that you can work and work and work and never see the result of it. But if you know exactly how to work, you can take that away. You can take away from that a lot of confidence in the process that you're on.
Beth Ann, well, we have a moment. I was settling in for the Nellie Korda, Jin Young Ko rivalry over the next decade. We have some new names here for Player of the Year. Is this a good thing or bad thing for the LPGA?
Well, you know, I like the fact that, you know, you have a lot of fresh blood and young talent, but ultimately I gravitate toward dominance. I really feel like that's what breaks through into other sports, into mainstream sports, where people really feel like they have a storyline that they can, and a face that they can latch onto. And I think that's why I got so excited about Rose Zhang, because I can tell you on the ground at KPMG at Baltusrol, I felt this energy that I hadn't felt in a long time out on this tour. And so that's why I was so all in on Rose Zhang. But, you know, obviously Celine Boutte's had a fantastic year. Lilia Vu, you know, winning two majors, Ronnie Yen, you know, breakout year for her. But at the same time, you know, when we're here at the Annika and we think about how Annika dominated and what that translated to in the sports world, and we think about Lorena, and I miss that. I would love to see players really follow up a good, you know, an excellent year with another excellent year. And it just feels like we haven't had that sustained excellence out here.
I don't disagree. I'm just going to give you one silver lining to the season that has been so far on the LPGA Tour. There's been five different number one in the worlds. It's been from all over the world. And I think that is important to the LPGA brand. You've got people in France that are cheering now for Celine Boutier. You've got Ronan Yin creating probably a whole host of young players in China that are going to want to grow up and be like her. There's and Jin Young Ko, Nellie Korda, Lilia Vu, whoever the player is that's hot, you're creating these new upswells of potential talent. And in this case, it's been from all over the world. So that's the silver lining to the lack of dominance, is you might actually be creating a wider breadth across the world.
Paige McKenzie thinking global. Great point. I like the silver lining. Great insight from Paige and Bethann this critical time of the year on the LPGA. Let's take a look at the Rolex Rookie of the Year standings. You talked a little about Player of the Year. How about Rookie of the Year? Two players have a mathematical chance to win. Kim would need to win the last two events to overtake you. Lots still to play for here in November on the LPGA Tour. And coming up next on Golf Today, we're joined by Angel Yin. Speaking of the LPGA, recently broke through for her first victory on the LPGA. What has her journey been like to the winner's circle? Find out next. Back on Golf Today, just a few weeks ago, Angel Yin defeated two-time major champ and UCLA Bruin Lilia Vu on the first playoff hole to win the Buick LPGA Shanghai for her first career LPGA Tour victory. It came in her 159th career start on the LPGA Tour. It's been a fantastic season for Angel. 17 events, got a victory, 6 top 10s, a third Solheim Cup appearance as well. And great to have Angel with us on this Wednesday. How about this year? You get your first win on the LPGA Tour, a third Solheim Cup. You said you've gone from desperate to grateful. What has that journey been like?
It's been a roller coaster, I would say, but it's always been good because, you know, you can't really overwrite these experiences because they make you who you are, and I'm just very grateful for everything that's happened.
Speaking of those experiences, we've seen people have tough playoff losses in majors, Angel, where it can almost work as a negative and kind of knock them on to their heels for a little while. We saw you come out of a playoff loss at the Chevron, and suddenly you've got that win, you've got a half dozen top tens. What kind of mindset did you leave Houston with that week? Was it that you were focused on taking away the positives, or were you still stung a little bit by the negative of having lost the playoff?
Yeah, see, I never took that as a negative. It was always a positive for me. You know, I wasn't playing very well and leading up to that moment. And when I got into that playoff and had that opportunity to win, I always took that as a positive. It was never a negative that I didn't win the tournament. It just showed me that, okay, look, I'm playing good enough to win. I just need to give myself another opportunity, another look, and then we'll see how it goes. And I created a lot of those opportunities for the rest of the year, especially in majors. And I was very, very happy with that.
Angel, speaking of positive, one of my favorite moments of the year happened on the 17th hole, final round in Shanghai. I want you to listen to this, and then I'll ask you about it on the other side.
Good vibes.
Yes, come on.
Go, Angel. She likes it.
Oh, I love her.
Yes, come on. I mean, that was affirmative, positive, and loud. How much have you leaned into being emotive on the golf course?
Yeah, I really, switched my mentality on that. Everyone growing up has always been, well, my mom especially, and, you know, showing how everyone plays, let's just say, like, MB, you know, they're a bit more flatlined on the golf course, and I've always been a little bit more emotional. And I don't know, I was watching tennis, Shanghai Masters, Saturday night, and I was watching Rublev, and He dug into his emotions, and I was like, you know, I should do that too. So I kind of did that, and also that was an 8 on hole, so that was pretty important. I knew the stakes, so I knew how much it meant to me. It was such a hard hole, and I knew how the leaderboard was standing. So all of it onto the 17th hole, that's why I was pretty excited.
You've had such tremendous expectations on you since you turned pro. Angel, was there a period over the last 5-6 years where you did start to have doubts as to whether or not you were going to get to this point where you were going to be a winner on the LPGA Tour and you were going to be a contender in major championships?
So my mind's always pretty split, and I'm always very positive to thinking, okay, I'm going to have an opportunity to win, and, you know, I am going to win. And then there's a part of me that's been really down the last few years where it's like, okay, maybe not. Maybe I should just hang out my clubs playing professionally, because I love playing golf just in general. And I actually really started finding that again. And I was going to play golf regardless to whatever I do in my professional career. But it got really hard, and I wasn't quite sure if this was it. And, you know, when you play really, really bad golf constantly, it's not good for you mentally.
Angel, you have an incredible personality. You're a lot of fun, but you've been largely sponsorless over the last 4 years, which I find completely confounding. Did that put extra pressure on you as well? Just the dollars and cents of this wacky business.
Yeah, I mean, it's very expensive, which people don't really realize that nothing is covered. Everything comes from our own pocket. And yeah, our entire earning is public, but you have to understand, like, a big portion goes to tax, a big portion goes to my caddy, and a big portion goes to travel. And people who are on my team, let's just say physios, who help me from my week to week. So there's a lot of expenses. And, you know, when COVID hit, it took a big hit on me, as it is for everyone. And with that, with my poor golf performance, without making that much money, there was like a point in one of the seasons was like, well, I need to make money now, or I'm not going to have enough money to fund me for the rest of the year. And it was Saudi. It was actually in Saudi. It was last year in Saudi Arabia. And I just had that thought.
So now, hopefully, as the performances are on the upward trajectory, so too is the money and hopefully the sponsor interest as well. You're now on the cusp of the top 20 in the world. If you're analytical, where do you see the room for improvement when you wanted to be top 10, top 5? What is there anything specific you think separates you right now from the women who are top 5 in the world?
Consistency. So I want to drive my consistency up a little bit more. The girls who are up there, I've always noticed that they're just super consistent with everything that they do, and I want to be able to do that. So I'm trying to create a routine that fits me the best, that I can sustain and repeat consistently, and then see if I can move my way up to that ranking.
Well, it's been a breakout year. You mentioned the Aon Risk Reward Challenge. You sit atop it right now, that leaderboard. You mentioned the par 5, 17th at Shanghai. What would winning that title signify to you?
Truthfully, it's pretty unbelievable, because I've always thought about it like lottery. Because it's just really hard to be under par on that specific hole every single week that they pick. For the entire year, it's really, really difficult. And where I'm in, the position I'm in right now, I'm just really grateful. And if I can pull it through, then that's awesome, and get to do things I want to do. And that to me is just lottery. And I think I'll be very happy for my caddy too, because he'll get a nice bonus.
No doubt, everybody wins. Angel, fun visiting with you. Congrats on a great year. Finish the year strong. We'll speak to you down the road.
Thank you.
Speaking of finishing the year strong, Charlie Wee entered the final round of the TimberTech Championship on the PGA Tour Champions last week, unsure of exactly where he'd be working next year. But by day's end, he'd secured his status for 2024. He's going to tell us how he got it done coming up next.
Back on golf today. In case you missed any of the players talking Butterfield Bermuda Championship, time now for Meet the Press.
I've said for years the coolest feeling on the tour is the week after you win, every one of your peers congratulating you. That's a good feeling, you know, because that 1 week, even if it's only 1 week, that 1 week you were better than everybody. And that's one of the main things that drives me. I just like to compete. And, you know, Michael and I lost dinner to a couple guys yesterday, and it drove me mad, you know, just – but –
as it did me, but yeah, just in a different way.
Right, yeah. It's because you got to pay for it. No, I'm kidding. But just like to compete. And the motivation is for me to stay relevant and to compete with these guys, I got to work extra hard because I'm older and slower and don't hit it as far and all the obvious things. But my body's holding up, my mind's sharp, and I still like to work at it. So, it's fun. There's never a time where I've said, you know, I don't really feel like practicing today. I just go see the guy hitting it 25 by me and hitting every par 5 and 2, and I usually go hit wedges. So so that's the motivation. Just want to compete. Want to beat them just like they want to beat me.
Yeah, this place is great. I had this kind of marked on my schedule after I didn't get it done last year that I wanted some redemption to come back and give it another chance. So Obviously a very beautiful place. I like the golf course, like the, you know, the course type with the Bermuda grass and the green types, and I feel like it's a course that sets up well for my game. So it was a no-brainer for me to be here this week, regardless of my positioning in the 51 to 60 category for the fall series. And yeah, just excited to give it another run and try to get this thing done.
Yeah, I think there were quite a few factors that fell into place that it really made sense to play this week. I was close by in Boston. This time of year, I'm really not around the East Coast normally, but there was the TGL announcement for Boston Common Golf. That was great. Great fun to be at Fenway Park yesterday for the day and see every bit of it. It felt like we did a lot of activities around there. It was really fun. Also, I'm playing in Australia in just a couple weeks' time, and after a fairly quiet period at the back end of the year, it's a good time to get going again and not only try and play well this week, but get ready to be going in Australia. And of course, I feel like I've played fairly solid all year and not got results, and I'm not going to get results being on the couch at home, and it'd be nice to get a result going on the PGA Tour before next season starts and try and improve my standings and get a position in a couple of these signature events.
I'll tell you, my expectation is pretty simple. I know that he's more than likely going to strike the ball above average to wildly above average, comparatively speaking, to these guys out here. I've seen it for a lot of years. It's nice that he actually gets the opportunity now to do it. And he's rolling the ball on like another planet right now. So,
I agree.
Now, sometimes things happen. Can fall apart from time to time in small subsets, like at Q School this past week.
Very small subsets, right?
There was a lot of big numbers on the card, but he still got through. So I think weathering those little storms that are going to come up mentally, I don't know how that's going to go because it's a little bit more of a magnifying glass out here. But as far as expectations, I wholeheartedly think that if he plays well, he has just as good a chance as anybody in the field to take down a trophy. So will it happen? Probably not. Am I pulling for it? Absolutely.
The trick shot, guys. I love the Bryan brothers. Lots to watch on Golf Channel this week. Ned Bank is Africa's major. Anika, driven by Gainbridge, Butterfield, Bermuda, Charles Schwab Cup Championship, and Golf Central. Golf Today, back after this.
We're back on Golf Today. This week is the finale of the Schwab Cup playoffs over on the PGA Tour Champions. You can catch first-round coverage of the Charles Schwab Cup Championship tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Golf Channel. And here are the current Charles Schwab Cup standings. Steve Stricker sealed the Cup victory a little while back on the road, but there's still plenty to play for at this time of the year, as we found out last weekend.
Got that right. How about Charlie Wee? Entered the second leg of the Charles Schwab Cup playoffs at number 54. Final round 64 on Sunday. The TimberTech Championship vaulted him inside the top 36, nearly holing out right there. He's qualified now for this week's Charles Schwab Cup Championship. Also now fully exempt on PGA Tour Champions for next year. And Charlie Wee joins us now from Phoenix. It's great to see you. You're a bright guy. UC Berkeley alum like myself. I went to grad school there, got a master's. Were you doing math and permutations on Sunday, or were you focused on the golf?
Well, I did check. Well, by the way, hi, guys. How you guys doing? And go Bears. So Sunday morning before I teed off, I did check the Charles Schwab Cup standings, and I saw that I was still projected at 53-54. So going out Sunday morning, I figured, well, let's put a good round in, because I know that higher you finish, more starts you'll get. So that was my intentions. I never had 36 on my mind, and so I was just very fortunate to shoot a good round, and a couple of good things happened for other players to help me get in the tournament this week.
So it's fair to say, Charlie, that your mentality was just that you needed the lowest possible number you could write on that scorecard Sunday, that you didn't actually have a target in your mind, because it seemed, did it seem out of reach, I guess, is the question?
Oh, definitely out of reach. I mean, I was 20th and I barely moved at all. So I knew that if I wanted to even finish in the 40s, I know that, you know, when you finish in the 40s, you probably get 15 to 18 starts. And that seemed like a lofty goal for me. And fortunately, I was able to put up a good number, and I again, I don't know how I'm here, but it's amazing.
Well, you're definitely there, now fully exempt for 2024 on PGA Tour Champions. But 6 years ago, you played in the Zurich with KJ Choi. He was egging you on, trying to get you to play more regularly, and you were like, I'm enjoying my time at home. So how are you balancing competing versus home time?
Well, so this year I didn't have full status, so that was really difficult for me because I have a 13-year-old son and a 17-year-old daughter. My daughter, she's a senior in high school, so she does her own thing, as we all know. And my son, who plays baseball, and he's a pretty good ball player, and I really miss him and not being there to help him get better. Because, you know, in golf, you could just go to the range and you can practice on your own. But in baseball, you need somebody to hit with, to catch with, and all different sorts of stuff. So every day I'm not there, he's not getting better. So when I was this year, there were many times, middle of the year, when I wasn't playing very well, I said, oh, do I still want to continue to do this? But, you know, Kirk Triplett talked me out of the jumping from the ledge a couple of times. And, you know, he's been a great mentor. So it's Tom Pernice, KJ Choi, and Wai Yang. You know, they've been very helpful mentally and just keeping me in the game.
You finished tied second at the weekend in the TimberTech Charlie. That was your second runner-up finish this year. And that's got to be a number you're getting a little bit tired of seeing on your resume. You had five runner-up finishes on the PGA Tour as well. But you've got to feel as though you're getting closer to hoisting one of those trophies.
You know what they say, if you knock on the door enough times, hopefully you'll break through. And, beginning of the year when I lost to Mark Hensby, a good friend of mine, I'm happy that he won, but at the same time, I really, really wanted to close that one out. And I knew I had some chances coming down the stretch and I wasn't able to converse. So I was a little disappointed losing in a playoff, but, you know, that also gave me an affirmation that I could still compete out here. And, you know, it gave me a lot of boost and confidence. And I remember flying home and say, wow, this is the reason why we play golf, is to compete. And so that really made me feel good.
How much do you do maintenance work out? You know, north of age 50, things get a little more difficult. How limber are you? How does your game compare to height of your power on the PGA Tour?
You know, I really haven't lost any ball speed. I do train every day at home. I go to the gym. I know that, you know, as you get older, you lose a lot of muscle mass. So I try to keep that in mind. And I always lift a lot of weights. And I probably don't do as many heavy weights as I used to. I probably used to squat like 185. Now I'll probably squat like 75-80% of my body weight. And, you know, I'll do smarter exercises instead of just trying to go at the heaviest I can. Another thing is that, you know, as you get older, you're not as flexible. So you want to be more limber. So heavier weights you do, you know, more muscle mass you have. And that gets, you know, it hinders with your backswing a little bit.
Charlie, you look great. You're playing great. Congratulations on being fully exempt. And enjoy the week in Phoenix. It's a big one.
Thank you, guys. It was great to see you guys. And go Bears.
Go Bears. Roll on, you Bears, as they say, out in Berkeley, California. Not too far away. How about Phoenix Country Club, Phoenix, Arizona? You can watch the Charles Schwab Cup Championship tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern time. First round coverage right here on Golf Channel.